Hey, folks, today's episode is sponsored in part by JustCoffee.coop. They have been sponsors of this program for 12 years. In fact, they've been sponsors of programs that I've been doing for 14 years, back from the Break Room Live days. They are a co-op, employee-owned co-op, fair trade, coffee, tea, or chocolate. They really support their growers in Central America and maybe some other places. I think they get some coffee from the African continent. Right now, if you have never tried Just Coffee, or if you've never tried the range of coffees they have, this is a sale for you. It only lasts, I think, about a week. I'll have more details on that next week. But go now to justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MR25. That's different. Usually it's majority, but today it's MR25. You will get 25% off your coffee. Check it out. This is a great opportunity for you to find the new coffee you love. MR25 for 25% off at justcoffee.coop. Now, the show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, June 24th. 2022. My name is Sam Speeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jamelle Bouie, opinion columnist at the New York Times and co-host of the Unclear and Present Danger podcast. Also on the program, the shoe has dropped, ladies and gentlemen. In a sweeping decision, the Supreme Court has overturned the 50-year precedent, Roe v. Wade, and also the Casey case to deprive our citizenry of the right to an abortion. And as of this morning at 10 a.m., abortion bans now exist in 13 states, with 13 more certain to follow within the coming weeks. Meanwhile, in coordinated raids, the DOJ seizes communication devices of the soft coup plotters on January 6th. And not the ones who were the stormtroopers. Speaking of which, Ron Johnson now admits he knew where what he was supposed to get to Mike Pence came from. Senate passes an anemic gun bill on the same day, the day after, I should say, the Supreme Court shreds any notion of gun control. Elon Musk says Tesla's new car factories are burning money, and not in a good way. I don't know what the good way is. Democrats are praying Joe Manchin will allow them to avoid the ACA subsidy rollback. And a UN agency also finds that the Israeli military likely the killers of a Palestinian-American journalist. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for being here. You have more than likely heard the news that the Supreme Court has, as anticipated, struck down Roe v. Wade and Casey. this was these were the decisions that gave found in the Constitution a right for women to, for that matter, people who are looking for an abortion to get one in this country and to have that right in a way that was unencumbered under Roe v. Wade. That decision was essentially the way this went into practice. There were three trimesters and there were different levels of burdens that the state could apply to that right depending on the trimester. A state could not ban abortion prior to trimester one. They had more flexibility to restrict it in certain ways in trimester two, and in trimester three could restrict it unless it involved rape, incest, or the life of the mother. And Casey changed the structure of that, allowed for essentially more restrictions placed on abortion beyond the time where it was largely accepted that a fetus could be viable outside the womb. That was 24 weeks. They were looking at a case, Dobbs, that dealt with, I think it was a 15-week abortion ban. It really was largely irrelevant. They superseded Casey. In other words, it wasn't just a matter of, well, we've changed our mind. It's not 24 weeks, it's 15 weeks now. No, they went even further and said that there is no right in this country, despite the fact that we have had that right for 49 years in this country, to an abortion. That there is no right to choose one. Therefore, a state can regulate it in any way they find fit. And in 13 states, as of this morning, abortions are banned. In 13 more states, and they had trigger laws waiting for a decision like this one. That's those states: Arkansas, Idaho, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, North Dakota, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, and Wyoming. They have different trigger laws, as it were. Kentucky, anyone who provides or attempts to provide an abortion will be charged with a 4-class D felony. Each one has, some nuance to it. There may be some exceptions in some of these states, but let's be clear about the exceptions too. And like I say, there's going to be 13 more states where these abortion bans will go into effect. Let's be clear on arguing whether a woman's life is in jeopardy, or there's incest, or there's rape. Maybe there's certain exceptions, et cetera, et cetera. Do not fool yourself. A doctor does not, when a woman's life is in danger by carrying a pregnancy to term, there's no light bulb that lights up. You can't look and say, oh, we can tell because their nose is turning red. Or here's a test. We have the results of the test. Positive, negative. Is the life in danger? Yes or no? No, it doesn't work that way. These are assessments that are made by doctors. And they are subjective assessments, like every assessment a doctor makes. And in that moment, when the doctor must make that assessment, that doctor is going to weigh two things. One, their subjective assessment, and two, prison time, fines, years of legal proceedings, loss of license. Every time they're faced with that decision. When a woman comes in because she's had a miscarriage and the embryo or the fetus has not flushed from their system, And there's potential that this woman could die of an infection if it is not out of their body. And the doctor weighs my subjective assessment of this, my completely objective assessment as to what I could be charged with. Will they find me guilty? I don't know. It's a function of my lawyer. Will I be ostracized? Will I lose my license? Will I lose my ability to practice at this hospital? These exceptions are not exceptions. Because the ban in and of itself serves to completely inhibit the ability, the will of abortion providers, and not just abortion, women's health providers, from doing their jobs because they don't want to go to jail. And you know, in all of these states, there are aggressive prosecutors who are like, this is the way that I'm going to make my name. So make no mistake about it. We have 26 states in this country. I would say by the end of this year, probably sooner, probably by the end of summer, where you will not be able to get an abortion. And if they do not have a medical abortion, importing of medical abortion medications, they will have one of those laws as well. And that's where we're at today. Today, if Donald Trump becomes president in 2024, or I should say 2025, or Ron DeSantis for that matter, and there's a Republican Senate and House, I would be willing to bet you anything by 2026, we have a federal ban on abortion. That's where we are today. And there are still 8 more decisions extant by the Supreme Court. And we're going to have, I mean, this is just going to keep coming. Got the West Virginia EPA. We've got the praying coach, although we saw basically we know what that's going to end up being. We saw the ruling the other day on the separation of church and state in the context of public and parochial schools. I mean, this is how Junes are going to go for the next 5 or 10, 15 years, 20 years. We're just going to see more and more individual rights get rolled back. We're going to see more and more ability for the government to function roll back. We're going to see the separation between church and state rolled back. I mean, it just goes on and on. Gun laws. In a moment, we're going to talk to Jamel Bowie about this. There were other things I wanted to talk to him about. We'll probably get to those as well. But this obviously is the big news of the day. A couple of words from our sponsors. I don't know that I've ever felt a more appropriate time to mention our sponsor, Sunset Lake Sebade. I have been increasingly using Sebade both as a sleep tool and as a relaxant in the evenings, and I've been smoking some of the pre-rolls. Well, right now, if you are into hemp flower, smalls, and keef, now is your time over at Sunset Lake Sebade. 50% off. Sun is shining, and the hemp plants are back in the field, big time. And at Sunset Lake Sebade, they are outside of Burlington up in Vermont. They're kicking off the summer with a huge sale. From now until Monday, June 27th. So that's just over the weekend. All of Sunset Lake Sebade's hand-trim hemp flower, smalls, and their premium dry sifted keef will be 50% off with the coupon code FLOWERPOWER. Matt is already getting in there. I have to say, like, Matt, why don't you talk about the smalls? You've been a fan of that for a long time.
Well, the smalls are great. They're already unstemmed sort of little things you can put right in your grinder. Also, I am a fan of these, and somebody else in my household is a fan of the new gummies that they have for sleeping.
Yes. Oh, the melatonin gummies are
awesome.
They're
amazing, yeah.
But right now, the sale is 50% off on the flower of the smalls. And I will say this. It is an interesting experience smoking it, because it is a different, like, you think that you're going to have a heady situation, and then it's you just get the relaxation. And I'm loving it.
Or maybe, you can add a little bit of relaxation to your heady experience.
Exactly. Sunset Lake CBD uses regenerative farming practices like cover cropping, crop rotation. They use beneficial insects to grow hemp flower without the use of harmful pesticides or synthetic fertilizers. That's called integrated pest management. The best part is they can ship these beautiful buds directly to your door in all 50 states. Sunset Lake CBD is a majority employee-owned business. They have donated more than $26,000 last year to anti-drug war organizations, to animal shelters, to union strike funds, to nature conservation places. They've done it to food pantries. They've done it to refugee resettlement organizations. They did it to Innocence Projects. They're a great company, folks. Again, visit sunsetlakesabade.com. Take advantage of these discounts. Sale ends at 11:59 p.m. on Monday. MR25. Oh, excuse me. Wait a second. No, Flower Power. Sorry about that. Flower Power gets you 50% off on all that. And lastly, folks know that I've been on my dental hygiene for years now. Thing that has made the huge difference for me is Quip. And not just their toothbrushes, but their flossers, their gum, their mouthwash, all of it. Quip gets your smile ready. It makes good habits easy. This is the whole thing. It doesn't matter what your toothbrush does if you don't use it on a daily basis. Quip makes it super easy. It's not a big, bulky electric toothbrush. It fits on your sink counter twice a day, tells you exactly the timing that you need for your mouth, a dentist recommended 2-minute clean. They have 30-second pulses so you can switch the different areas. Quip is an electric toothbrush you can travel with and constantly use. You build your whole routine with the reusable floss pickers, which are amazing. They have a refillable mouthwash, so you're not buying a bunch of plastic. They have brush heads and fresh floss. They will refill it every month for just $5, no extra shipping cost. This way, you start a good habit, you keep a good habit. My entire family now uses these toothbrushes, and my extended family. My sisters are on it, too. If you go to getquip.com/majority right now, you get your first refill free. Let's get your first refill free at getquip.com/majority. Check it out, ladies and gentlemen. You will not be disappointed. It's all about maintaining a good habit, and Quip lets you do that. All right.
Quick break.
Got to take a quick break. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes the show possible. Become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When we come back, we'll be talking to Jamel Bowie, opinion columnist at the New York Times, co-host of the Unclear and Present Danger podcast. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Emma Vigeland out today on vacation. Joining me, Jamel Bowie. He is a columnist, opinion columnist at the New York Times, co-host of the Unclear and Present Danger podcast. Jamel, welcome back to the program. This sounds This is the low rent way to say it, but the danger seems pretty present and pretty clear today.
Yes, it does. Today
sorry,
is.
I couldn't help myself with that.
It is quite a day.
So there's a couple of pieces that you've written in the past couple of weeks, which I think very applicable to just look back on this week. But obviously today, we heard from the Supreme Court. And I have to say, I thought this was going to be the last case they announced. It's not. There's eight more cases or so that are extant. We'll hear about those presumably either Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday, but not much further than I would imagine the end of next week. Let me read this tweet because it dovetails in actually with a piece that you wrote about the gerontocracy in the Democratic Party. Chris Hayes writes, there's something that Jamelle Bouie and Rebecca Traister have both been writing about. The gap between the Democratic leadership and younger progressives on the question of how bad is it is just enormous. And this is a response to a tweet by Dylan Wells. Dylan Wells is covers, I guess, Congress and campaigns for USA Today. And she writes, just asked Whip Clyburn about the Dobbs decision. This is the one that has overturned Roe v. Wade, rolled back an individual right for the first time in this country that has existed for 50 years. It's a little anticlimactic. I think we all expected this, and I'm hopeful. I have to read the decision to see exactly to the extent which we can move legislatively to respond to it. We can talk about the subsidiary question as to it's anticlimactic. Maybe that was part of the leak intention in the first place.
Yeah.
But B, really? Is this your first response?
No, I mean, I think this response gets to exactly what Rebecca has been writing about, exactly what I have been writing about, which is the proper response from one of the top leaders of the party ostensibly committed to the protection of abortion rights should not be this is anticlimactic. The response should be some way that you signal to the people paying attention to you that you understand that they understand that your hair is on fire, that people's hair should be on fire, that this is a serious and grave moment and that the party is beginning to move or is moving now to do something about it. The extent to which Whip Clyburn's response seems to suggest that, you know, things we'll just have to wait and see how things play out is totally not appropriate for the moment and is an indication, I think, of just how out of touch, not just with the political moment, so much the leadership of the Democratic Party is. And the, you know, the headline of that piece was the gerontocracy. And these are very large, by and large, older people in their 70s and even 80s, but also a lack of awareness of just the kind of fight that they're in. And that's the thing that remains baffling to me, that people who seem to have been on the front lines of the radicalization of the Republican Party still seem not to understand that that's the fight they're fighting. That's the battle they're in.
And before I get more emails about my ageism, the gerontocracy is not just simply a number in terms of how old they are. It is that they are their political thinking is ossified. Obviously, there are people who are of that age who are far more clear on what's
right.
going on.
Yes.
And we see some of them in the Senate. You know, I mean, there are people like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and others who can articulate this idea that and what's amazing about this, too, just as a side note. Bill Clinton, maybe his most famous line was, "I feel your pain."
Right.
And this is, you know, so, I mean, these people, you know, they are very much associated with that early 90s politics. And yet this is, I mean, it's both a combination of what it seems to me an ossified view of what's going on politically and also just a real inability to do politics. Like, this is like a competency question, too.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you made the point about how the gerontocracy thing isn't just about the age people, because the piece itself, I specifically do argue that the problem is that, you know, people like Biden, like Clyburn, like Dianne Feinstein, like Nancy Pelosi, their formative political experiences were really in the late 60s and the 70s, which is just an entirely different United States than we exist in now. It sort of doesn't seem like it because, again, these people are still in leadership. Plenty of people who were adults in the 60s and 70s are alive and well now. But, you know, the distance between 2022 and 1972 is the same as the different distance between 1972 and 1922, right? It's sort of, it's entirely different political era that engendered very different political lessons than the one you should take now. And it's noteworthy, as you point out, that someone like Elizabeth Warren, who really comes into national politics in the 2000s, has a very different assessment of what the Republican Party is than people close to her in age. Bernie Sanders, likewise, has been in politics for a while, but for most of his career has been on the outside, which gives you a different perspective on the way things work out and the way things play out than someone who is in it and who is part of, say, legislative coalitions with Republicans, who is part of this kind of moderate bipartisan camaraderie in Washington. And the extent to which leaders of the Democratic Party still think that that's a thing that's possible in the current environment is kind of the problem. It's one thing to pine for it, right? It's one thing to think it'd be nice to have that back. But to think that it is a live option, assuming certain conditions are met, it's just not the case. And acting as if that were the case leads you into a lot of trouble. And as you say, it leads you to not do politics in the most effective ways that you could do politics. So these January 6th hearings are happening, and they're much more informative, and they have much greater reach than I think a lot of people expected and anticipated. And I think that in fact is kind of a lesson, right? That you have these episodic hearings, each one a big new revelation that, you know, shines light on some new terrible aspect of wrongdoing. Each revelation attracting lots of attention from the press, lots of attention from other politicians, and building a narrative over time that keeps the pressure on your political opponents. And this is exactly what people were calling for during the Trump presidency, during all the constant revelations of wrongdoing, to just open up kind of free-form investigations to keep the pressure on. In the sense that politics is not just a question of establishing moments, but attracting attention, establishing narratives, driving the conversation, doing things that create a splash and force people to react to you, is something that, you know, to his great advantage, Trump realizes and figures out somewhat intuitively, but that the leadership of the Democratic Party seems still unwilling to embrace that, except for like select circumstances.
And I mean, there's the two things occur to me. One is, you know, we see even, you know, and again, it's not necessarily age, but it is about when you sort of grew up politically.
Right.
We can see even with people who I don't appreciate ideologically, and the so-called frontline Democrats, even those who I would consider corporatist or, have problems with them ideologically, they seem to understand at the very least the partisan aspect of these politics,
right,
in a way that people who supposedly I'm more aligned with ideologically, but who grew up in that era politically, don't. And, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence that even like folks like Josh Gottheimer, who I would, you know, travel great lengths to replace in Congress. I really don't want to get to, but you understand at the end of the day, we need to pass this, right? I mean, yeah. And granted, it's the House as opposed to the Senate, but I do not think, and maybe Kristen Sinema is younger and has a different perspective on this, but I don't think without Joe Manchin in there, who, you know, I also think he's just motivated by his by his own self-interest and corporate interests, but he still feels like he can get away with pretending it's about bipartisanship on some level, and politically it's been advantageous to him. But we can see this is a generational divide, and you made the point, And I just want to say here, I did not plagiarize from you, but you make the point. You go, you outline it in that piece. Nancy Pelosi, how many times has she said, we need strong Republicans? Joe right. Biden praising Mitch McConnell as a man of honor, as if he wasn't there when Mitch McConnell broke the Senate. Right. And I would still argue that we saw this in the Clinton campaign in 2016, where they were trying to preserve, they allowed McConnell and Ryan to be over here and Trump over here instead of like binding them together. I mean, exactly. I think we're still seeing this with Biden coming up with Uber MAGA. Like how thinly do you need to slice this? And frankly, and I understand why they're doing it, and I think there's some advantages to doing it in terms of, to bringing out Republican witnesses during these January 6th hearings. But again, we talk about this with Pence. They seem to be allergic to the concept of Donald Trump was not delivered by aliens. Right. You know, he didn't parachute out of nowhere. He was like literally birthed, and that works both ways, out of the Republican Party.
No, I think that's exactly right. I mean, there seems to be this idea that you can, I'll rewind. There's a kernel of like an actual insight here, which is that like it is unsustainable, right, in the long term to think that to fix the problem you can just beat Republicans all the time. It's like probably not a thing that's going to happen, just for the simple reason that politics swings back and forth. That's just how these things work. But based on that kind of that true observation, there seems to be a belief that the task ahead of Democrats is to help shape some kind of responsible Republican Party. But I just don't think that's how this works. The amount of time a party needs to be out of power to begin to change course isn't really that long, right? Like you can see this in the 1980s. It's 10 years between Carter, 12 years between Carter and Clinton. And in those 12 years, the Democratic Party changes tremendously to accommodate a decade of defeats. And what Republicans did during that time was not try to like cleave off the labor left from the Democratic Party and say, well, these are the good Democrats and these are the bad Democrats. They said, yeah, they're all terrible. You know, like they're all Jimmy Carter. They're all sort of they're all responsible for the inflation. They're all responsible for the things you don't like. And Democrats seem to have a real allergy to doing exactly that, to saying they're all Trump. And even if the committee can't do something like that, it's certainly the case that the larger political leaders can do it. They can say, you know, we look at this and yeah, you know, Pence may have done the right thing eventually, but most of the Republican Party is with these people. So you have to make a choice. Do you want those people in power or do you want us in power? Offering to voters a clear choice instead of, you know, what usually Democrats seem to do is say, well, you know, you vote for us and we'll protect democracy. It's like, what does that mean? But if you say to them, you vote for us and we'll do X, Y, and Z for you and we'll keep those people from acting like maniacs, that might appeal to people. And it just seems to be a step that the leadership doesn't want to take, or much of the leadership doesn't want to take. And I think it's in part because there's no experience doing politics in that kind of hard-nosed, hard-edged partisan way. Like, it's just not a way Democrats have been doing things. For a bunch of reasons that make sense structurally, right? Like, it's a big heterogeneous party. There's lots of moderates and liberals and progressives and even some conservatives. And so the preoccupation of party leaders has been an attempt to corral all these cats and find some sort of like way to unify all of them in the course of trying to win elections. But I think this is maybe seem a little off topic, but I've been reading about the early Republican Party in the 1850s and mainly the 1850s and sort of the parties that preceded it in the 1840s, the Liberty Party, the Free Soil Party, the Know Nothing Party. And it's interesting to read about how the new nascent Republican leaders are similarly trying to corral a lot of different kinds of people under a single umbrella. And part of their solution is just to be sort of like hard-edged partisans. to sort of not really give any quarter, because that sense of partisan competition can bring people together. We may disagree about all this other stuff, but we do have one objective: to beat this other side. And I think that's, I think that embrace of partisanship is really underrated among Democratic leaders, which sounds like a strange thing to say in like an age of polarization and partisanship. But I think if you just observe how the party leaders on both sides, the rhetoric, how they talk about things, you'll notice a willingness to embrace partisanship among Republicans and a real allergy to it among Democrats.
It's bizarre. I mean, it is full on bizarre, because the what you described with, you know, what ultimately became the radical Republicans, that dynamic we see play out in international relations all the time. I mean, if Castro wanted to rally, was feeling there was domestic weakness at home, he would raise the specter of a U.S. boogeyman. George Bush, same thing. I mean, we see this happens all the time. I mean, we see with Putin, we see with every leader of every country. Your weakness at home, well, then you find an external enemy, and that's the way that you bring people together. I mean, so that concept, it just, the idea that it escapes them, and it's fine to say vote for us, we'll protect democracy. Again, I'm not sure what that means, but who is we protecting democracy from?
Right.
It's the Republicans. But so how do you then say, turn around and say, like, and by golly, we'll pass this bipartisan bill to, you know, repair the highways with them too. It just doesn't make any sense.
Like, to be really concrete about this, you know, today the Supreme Court finally issued its ruling in Dobbs. It overruled Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey. The Constitution no longer protects abortion. What should have happened, in my opinion, like as soon as that ruling came down, which the White House knew was coming down, we had the leaked draft. The actual opinion is like not that different from the leaked draft. So the White House knew this was happening, had time to prepare. That 5 minutes after that draft came down, President Biden should have had a press conference where he says straightforwardly, this is objectionable. Here's why. The Republican Party wanted this and supported this. These are Republican judges who did this. And if you want federal protection of abortion rights, then all we need is a Democratic House and another Democratic senator. We need one more senator and one more person in the Senate. Vote for us, and we will do this thing. And that's the appeal, and that's the attack. And I'm not saying it's going to work, but I am saying that.
But that's the best attempt. That's an attempt.
Right. I mean, it's saying to voters that here is the problem, here is the obstacle, and here is to overcome the obstacle is at least something. It is something to get people to understand what they can do to change the situation.
Of course, the ship is sinking, and we should bail. Well, do we know for a fact that that's going to save us? Well, no, but we should bail. I mean, we don't have many other options. And instead, we get the number three in the House.
Exactly.
Saying, it doesn't seem like that big of a deal. It's anticlimactic. You know, we'll see. Be, hope springs eternal. And it's insanity. I mean, it's like the fact that there is not anything like what you're talking about is, I mean, it really is just, I just don't understand it. And I will say that, like, you know, there is a fair criticism of the Democrats for not locking this in statutorily.
Yes.
In the chances they've had in the past. But also, people should not forget this history. In 2004, I believe it was, in the run-up to the 2004 election, it may have been after the 2004 election, Hillary Clinton was one of the stronger voices in saying, we need to be a little bit softer on abortion. We need, in fact, I think that's part of the reason why Obama in 2007, when he was running, was adamant about passing this, because there was a move in the Democratic Party to sort of soften the edges. I mean, we see, you know, and I don't, I'm only picking on Hillary Clinton because she just happened to sort of do the same thing about transgender rights in a piece. It's unclear to me how it was presented. I didn't see her complain about the way that it was written in the Times, not necessarily your paper, but
Financial Times.
It was in the Financial Times. Yeah. But we see this tendency of Democrats. And that is why, you know, and fair enough, I think, you know, when Obama got into office, he said it's no longer a legislative priority. When he said it was the first thing he was going to do, he didn't know there would be a financial crisis. But nevertheless, the fear of Democrats to sort of push these things that have these type of popularity is, I mean, that we're still stuck in this triangulation mentality with these people.
Yeah, I mean, there's the decision not to try to codify Roe really is baffling. I mean, there's the cynical explanation, right, that, you know, as long as Roe isn't codified, then you have, you know, you can say, hey, people come out and vote, donate, et cetera, et cetera. There might be a vested interest among sort of the various kind of like, you know, politicians and the nonprofit industrial complex and everything around not just doing this legislatively. But at the same time, ostensibly, you know, Roe is the thing that unites the Democratic coalition. I mean, even in 2009, you didn't quite have a filibuster-proof majority in those first few months, but you had a large majority in the House. And the number of Democrats who would have blanched from codifying Roe, which is nationally very popular, I have to imagine is pretty small. So it's mystifying to me why this didn't happen. I mean, there's a lot of explanations, but it didn't. And it just hasn't been a priority. Part of me thinks that there just was disbelief that the Supreme Court would take this step, or that the Supreme Court would even ever be in the position to take this step. I mean, I remember hearing, I remember people are making this argument that, oh, you know, Republicans are never actually going to overturn Roe because it's too good of a thing to get their base all riled up. It's too good of a motivator for the voters. And there seems to have been a belief that Republicans and the conservatives from the core and the conservative legal movement didn't really mean it. But they very clearly meant it.
Yes.
this is sort of one of the things I occasionally rant about is just sort of the incredible level of cynicism about politicians to the point that people just do not believe anything they say they're going to do, which is to the benefit of sort of the worst actors in politics. Because if everyone believes that politicians are just always going to lie, then the people when Donald Trump says I'm going to ban Muslims, and it's like, oh, he doesn't really mean it. And then he does it because he meant it. And like most of the time, even if people are duplicitous politicians, even if they aren't fully honest, most of the time they mean what they say. And we should take that seriously. When a bunch of reactionaries say we want to overturn the right to an abortion, they mean it. Clarence Thomas, in his concurring opinion on Dobbs, said the court should overturn Griswold v. Connecticut, should overturn Obergefell, should overturn Lawrence v. Texas, right? Like, that isn't idle rhetoric. Like, he means it. And there are lots of people in the Republican Party and in the conservative movement who agree with him. And so the reaction should be not to say, well, you know, you don't got to worry about that stuff. The reaction should, you should act as if, no, they're going to do it. If they get the opportunity, they're going to do it.
We should say Thomas also oddly left out Virginia.
Although I think he'd overrule that too. I don't think that would stop. I don't think his marriage would stop him from doing that.
No, they could still be good friends. and that dynamic, we should say, you know, reminds me of that story. And for the life of me, I can't remember where there has been focus groups where they have presented like the Republican platform to voters.
Right.
And the voters say like, no, we don't believe that that's what the platform is. Like, it's so outrageous that they do not believe that it's going to happen. And to some extent, like, I feel like we are entering a period of time in our politics where, and it's really just a question of like, does this take 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, where, because we're going to get West Virginia and EPA next week, and that is going to be the next step in the essentially the destruction of our administrative state. Right. And the ability of our government to regulate stuff, you know, we're not that far out from, you know, more salmonella and more E. coli in our food. And I mean, the financial markets being far less regulated and environment and clean air, clean water. I mean, just on and on and on. And we have multiple generations who have grown up without even the contemplation of this. You know, I mean, people in the 60s, they could remember what things were like 30 years before. There was like an institutional memory and where, you know, oh, 60-hour work week? Sorry, New York. We're not going to – you can't put a cap on how many hours we work our sweatshop folks. You know, that was in the body politic in the, you know, in the 50s and the 60s, and it became – just an assumption it's always going to be like that. And I feel like there's a whole mess of people who are about to find out it doesn't always have to be like that.
Right. I mean, I'm sure you can call this silver lining, but the closest thing to a silver lining here is precisely this fact, right? That sort of like what Americans have grown accustomed to is a government that protects their rights, is a government that does at least something to regulate the pollution in our air and in our water and in our, you know, in our consumer goods. And I think there is an opportunity. It's not going to be automatic, right? It's not going to be an automatic reaction, but there's an opportunity for a political party that wants to take it in these rulings, in making the case that, like, this is what the Republican Party wants. Like, at the end of the day, this is what it wants. It wants to essentially unleash the most powerful corporations and the wealthiest people to do whatever they want. It wants to unleash sort of like the worst busybodies you can imagine to control your life, to control who you can marry and whether you can end your pregnancy and all sorts of things. And it wants to restrict your right to vote so they keep you from doing something about it. So let's like collectively stop these people. But again, this requires sort of like, you know, you don't have to say that these people are the enemy, but you do have to treat them as opponents, as people who need to be like beaten, which is a thing that, you know, the generation of Democrats who helped build the administrative state, the FDR generation, knew how to do, right? Like, they did not hesitate to treat Herbert Hoover as someone who needs to be like swept away to the ash heap of history.
Do you think, I mean, and I don't know that you would have more insight to this, but, you know, you mentioned earlier Joe Biden could be in front of the microphones right now, knowing that this was, it was about to drop any day and there would be a statement and there would be a plan. Do you think, I mean, and I'm thinking like, okay, Susan Collins could be that 50th vote, theoretically, right? I mean, you have races in New Hampshire where this could make a big difference. Maybe even in Arizona. I don't know. Although, you know, you got Blake Masters. I don't know. But there are Senate races where this could have serious implications for those races because they could be the vote, you know, that would have overturned it. I mean, at least unlikely the House is going to, we're going to have the House come January, but one never knows. But have you seen any shadows or hints or clues that there is a brain trust saying, okay, this is how we map this out over the course of the next 30 months? I think it's very likely that if you have a Republican controlled House and Senate and presidency, that by 2026, which is not that far fetched of an idea, by 2026, there's a federal ban on abortion.
Right.
And I mean, period, end of story. And, you know, you could have you know, wealthy people in Brooklyn being like, well, it's not going to necessarily implicate me, but it's not going to be hard to find some you know, district attorney somewhere in a lot of these other states who are going to like, this is the way I'm going to make my name for myself. I'm going to go after the people who are importing the medical abortions from Canada or whatever.
So two things. The first is that it's funny, as we were speaking, Biden gave an address and sort of made some of the points that I wanted him to make, that this was a radical decision. Boom. This is an extreme decision. And that, you know, the White House should do it as much as it can to mitigate it. And that this is on the ballot. So this is, I mean, this is exactly the kind of thing you want to hear. And I don't have any unique insight.
They're listening to the show.
They're listening to the show, right? They heard me. I still think it should have happened like immediately. It should have been sort of like, you know, a decision comes down and then sort of like now an address from the president. A couple hours. Okay. That's fine. As far as I don't have any unique insight, you know, my assumption has to be that organizations, activists are already doing the work and planning to figure out how to respond to this on the ground for women who need abortions. I think that's sort of their paramount thing. For the women who need abortions in states like Texas, right, one of the largest states in the union, states like Florida, one of the largest states in the union, I think organizations have been and are working to do what they can to ensure that those women can get abortions. As far as the political question goes, though, I'm not sure. I mean, I have to imagine that there are at least sort of Democratic campaigns and such strategizing about this. But I also happen to think, you know, this is probably the time for real national messaging from the National Democratic Party, for, you know, the leaders of the Democratic Party, Biden, Pelosi, Schumer, the most prominent voices, to be kind of united on this and say, you know, on the ballot in November, whether you live in Arizona, whether you live in New Hampshire, whether you live in Georgia, Pennsylvania, on the ballot in November is whether or not the right to an abortion survives in the United States. And so if you want it to survive, cast your ballot for the Democrats. Doesn't matter who they are. Cast your ballot for the Democrat. And if you don't, cast your ballot for the Republican. And sort of just make it, this is what the situation is. That to me is sort of that would be the right approach. The proof of concept here would be the 2021 Georgia runoff elections, where the pitch of Warnock and Ossoff was, if you want additional assistance in the pandemic, vote for the Democrat. If you don't, vote for the Republican. Clear choices, clear lines of responsibility. We'll have to see what the Democratic Party's messaging.
I feel like that lesson was learned and stuck with them for about 2.5 months.
Yeah.
maybe somewhere between like 10 and 14 weeks. I feel like that really resonated. And then it just all sort of melted away. They completely forgot that we just pulled off. And the thing that people forget too is that there was a lot of voters who voted in the presidential election and left, you know, Trump's name blank. And I mean, so that runoff election was even harder in some ways than getting to the runoff election to win. And the value of saying $2,000 check, it's impressive how people sort of memory hold that in some ways.
I'll say this real quick. I just saw that Joe Manchin, West Virginia senator, says he would vote to codify Roe into law. So, you know, there's at least 49 votes right there. I'm sure Sinema would be the 50th.
Is there a way to put that in reconciliation?
You'd have to stretch. It'd be a real stretch, which is why, I mean, the way.
What if you were to provide like a $10 subsidy?
You know what? That would be it, right? You provide a $15 to every household to purchase
are we medicated in a negotiation, you and I, right now?
Yeah.
I say 20. No, but yes, I mean, 15 bucks per household, right?
Or something like that.
You know, abortion provider coupon.
Yeah, that'd be the way to do it. Or otherwise, you'd have to get rid of the filibuster. Yes. But again, again, this goes back to sort of how to talk about this for an election. You know, pretty much, it seems like Sinema and Manchin are the last two Democrats right now who are willing to publicly say they oppose them in the filibuster. There are certainly others, but they are the two who are publicly say it. But Fetterman in Pennsylvania has said he would vote to end the filibuster. I think all the Democratic candidates on the ballot for the Senate have said they would vote to end the filibuster. And so there you go. You cast a ballot for a Democrat, we'll vote to end the filibuster, and then on the first day of the new session of Congress, we're going to codify Roe. And then that's your promise to people. And you go from there. You run on that.
Can we just talk for a minute before we go? And I appreciate your staying this long about Mike Pence, because there's a Mike Pence problem that is greater than Mike Pence, and I think it extends, you know, frankly, to you know, during Trump, it extended to David Frum, you know, and to the Lincoln Project and to a whole cadre of people. I mean, my feeling is like they're a tool. That's fine. Use the tool, hammer the nail, but don't become enamored with this tool because it's just a tool. And in Pence, I mean, you made this point that he in the Woodward Acostas book that he was calling Dan Quayle and looking for a way in. When they said that Eastman was in his office on January 5th,
right?
Like, what if he had already decided this is bat crap crazy, I'm not doing it, why is he spending hours with Eastman? And his lawyer is basically saying, like, this is not right, you can't do it. This was like, it was like the Lepage having the sovereign citizens coming in and his lawyers trying to say, like, yeah, no, you can't assassinate the Speaker of the House. That's just not what they're talking about. It's wrong. I mean, Pence wanted to do it. He right. wanted to do it. He was just making a calculation and could figure out a way to do it.
So, yeah. So this is, I feel like this is a point, you know, I've been sort of hard on Democrats in our conversation. I've been kind of hard on Democrats recently, but I think it's also important to say that the mess that we're in is like 90% the fault of Republicans who let Trump in, who supported Trump, who were behind Trump as long as it seemed like he was winning, who were behind Trump even after he lost. And this is the Pence thing, that if there had been a more plausible way to do it, Pence obviously would have tried to overturn the election. And it was only his belief, eventual belief, that this was the end of the line, that Trump really had lost, that kept him from taking that step. And it's clear to me, at least, that across the Republican Party establishment, there was a willingness to go along with the scheme, and that the thing that stopped them wasn't some commitment to democracy. It was a sense that the rationale wasn't plausible enough. The election wasn't close enough. But if the election had just hinged on Arizona, if it had just hinged on Georgia, if it just hinged on Wisconsin, I think they would have gone along with it.
Giuliani is just a unit or two less of a drunk. And I think that, like, you know, like, and you weren't talking about the lunatics who are, I mean, this is a pretty loony group of people who are involved in this, but it didn't take, you know, even that was not, you know, they were still like, we're on board if you could just bring us something, anything.
Right. And so this attempt to make Pence out to be a hero, to make these people out to be heroes, I understand why they're doing it politically, but I don't like it because I don't think it's true. I don't think Pence is a hero. I think Pence is a guy who got scared and acted according to that fear. And I'm glad he did. I think he was right to be scared. But this wasn't some great moment of integrity. It was someone who desperately wanted to deliver for Trump, who has shown no real independence from Trump at any point in his time in that administration, who joined the Trump ticket. I mean, the fact that Pence willingly jumped onto that ticket says all you need to know about the guy.
Right.
And his actions on January 6th, I think I said this in the piece, are sort of the absolute minimum of what we should expect from a constitutional officer. Nothing worthy of exceptional praise or anything like that. I actually used much harsher language in the column, but then I decided I should probably just tone it down a little bit.
There you go. Well, I should say one clarification on our idea of the $10, $15, $20 coupon. The Hyde Amendment at this point.
That's right. Yes.
You'd have to reverse the Hyde Amendment. The Hyde Amendment, of course, was an amendment to, to Medicare or Medicaid, basically saying that no federal dollars can go directly towards an abortion.
Right. It's for Medicaid.
But I would presume maybe you overturn that Hyde Amendment. That may be trickier politically, but I mean, this is where we're at. And I don't know how else you do that other than maybe you make it like a tax rebate and it becomes less onerous. You repeal the Hyde Amendment and then do a tax rebate or something to that effect.
Or, again, you end the filibuster. You recognize that it's a fake obstacle. Anything that can be removed with a majority vote like that is a fake obstacle. So just get rid of it and do what you were elected to do.
You could call it the anytime an individual right that has existed in this country for over 25 years has been rolled back act. And get your one-time filibuster exception. Jamel Bowie, thank you so much. I got to tell you, I've been reading you probably since you were the American Prospect, like 2 decades ago, right? Or something?
10 years ago. I'm not that old.
Okay. Sorry. I'm that old. I've been reading you for a long time and really, really appreciate the work you're doing. And thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, folks, we will put links to Jamel's recent pieces at majority.fm and to the Unclear and Present Danger podcast. I guess I'm getting old, but I'd remember when he was, and he was, I think he was, I remember when he was like an intern at the American Prospect.
Yeah, he's from like when I used to follow news through RSS feeds.
Yep. Damn, I'm old. We're going to head into the... to the fun half.
The fun half.
Yeah. I mean, let me just do one more thing in the free half of the program regarding the ruling. Obviously, we're going to spend the next couple of weeks talking about the actual ruling. This one, the other ones, we're going to have, like I say, there's... We had today... Dobbs and what was the other one? Was it Empire Health? I think that came around. We're going to have in the coming days Concepcion, which is a sentencing one, West Virginia versus the EPA, which we've talked about quite a bit on this program, which specifically deals with climate change, but it really deals with this principle of the major questions principle and the non-delegation principle and the Chevron doctrine, all that stuff that allows our government to function. There is another bill, case Ron involving the prosecution of physicians, Torres and the question of sovereign immunity, Kennedy, which is that case of the coach who was praying after football games. Again, we got an indication. I think it was in Bruin or the main case that came out last week that involved separation of church and state. There's a couple others, but the main ones, like I say, Dobbs, West Virginia, arguably Kennedy. Dobbs we've had. I'm sorry, West Virginia and Kennedy. We'll be talking more about that coming up. But there are two things I want to just point out from these decisions. And it's unclear to me at this point how much Alito's brief tracks with what came out. I believe at first blush, the main difference is that the language that Alito had put in about those cases that Jamel Bowie mentioned, Griswold, which has to do with birth control. This was a case, I believe, in the 50s. Maybe it was this early 60s. where the court found a right to privacy involving people taking birth control. Lawrence was a case out of Texas. I believe this was in the aughts, that there was a law on the books in Texas that you could not, Griswold was 65. Lawrence was 2003. Thank you. You could not engage in anal sex, or I think in some instances also oral sex. And this struck that down. Obergefell, of course, was the case that Supreme Court found a right to marriage equality. So Thomas writes in his concurring opinion, these were mentioned in the Alito brief. And do we have a tear sheet of this? Is this a number? No, it doesn't. Okay, we'll get to that in a second. Thomas says, in future cases, we should reconsider all of these courts' substantive due process precedents. That is, out of due process comes these rulings. They are founded in that. And the 14th Amendment, also we mentioned Loving v. Virginia, is also one that came out of that. He didn't mention it. Loving v. Virginia is, of course, the thing that makes it. Here we go. And this is, it is unclear. Originally, Alito had it in his brief, and I suspect to the extent that there was any change, it was, Thomas, you're going to have to do this on your own. We're not going to put it into the main brief. But let's be clear, folks. This is going to be cited. I promise you. I don't know if it's going to happen next year or in 2 years or in 3 years. But over the next year to 3 years, you're going to see some circuit, maybe it's the Fifth Circuit, maybe it's some other circuit, where there is a majority of Republican-appointed federal judges. They are going to rule on the question of Griswold, on the question of Lawrence, on the question of Obergefell, maybe even Loving v. Virginia. And they're going to rule in a way that chips away, if not reverses or attempts to reverse these. And maybe the circuit court won't reverse it because of precedent, but this Thomas brief will be cited. And these precedents will be tested. And there is no reason to believe that the marriage equality precedent is any more robust than a precedent that has existed in this country for about a quarter of its existence. Maybe, I guess, a fifth of its existence. This court does not care about precedent. Here is Samuel Alito writing, there is no right to an abortion in the Constitution. The Constitution does not afford people a right to any type of biological or physiological, pop this up, freedom, as it were. You have this? This is clip number one, right? Here it is. The Constitution does not confer a right to an abortion. Roe and Casey are overruled, and the authority to regulate abortion is returned to the people and their elected representatives. Even though we know in many of these states, at the very least, minoritarian rule. There was a joint dissenting opinion, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan, and this is what they wrote here. Put this up. It starts, there was no support. because at one point, you know, the question that the Alito is saying is there support for, is there, you know, we cannot find any type of right that did not exist at the time of our founding. You know, these are rights that just came up in the 20th century. It is an absurd perspective on this. But they're talking about, they're bringing this up. Lawrence v. Texas, Obergefell, they're writing, these are all part of the same constitutional fabric, protecting autonomous decision-making over the most personal of life decisions. The majority, or to be more accurate, most of it, is eager to tell us today that nothing it does, quote, cast doubt on precedents that do not concern abortion. Now, to be clear, Thomas, again, wrote, advocated, and they mentioned this, the overruling of Griswold, Lawrence, and Obergefell. But just because the Supreme Court, the opinion says, now keep that up, please. Just because the opinion says that today's ruling does nothing, does cast doubt on precedents that do not concern abortion, doesn't mean that today's ruling does not cast doubt on precedents that do not concern abortion. Remember, the Bush v. Gore, they argued, this has no precedents. Do not cite this case. Never talk about it again. This is a one-off. But the fact is that it's been cited over and over and over in election cases. And this one will be too. In fact, they write, but how could that be? How could it be that this does not cast doubt on precedents that are outside of abortion? How could that be? The lone rationale for what the majority does today is that the right to elect an abortion is not, quote, deeply rooted in history, end quote. Not until Roe, the majority argues, did people think abortion fell within the Constitution's guarantee of liberty. The same could be said, though, of most of the rights the majority claims it is not tampering with. The majority could write just as long an opinion showing, for example, that until the mid-20th century, quote, there was no support in American law for constitutional right to obtain, in parens, contraceptives. So one of two things must be true. Either the majority does not really believe in its own reasoning, or if it does, all rights that have no history stretching back to the mid-19th century are insecure. Either the mass of the majority's opinion is hypocrisy, or additional constitutional rights are under threat. It is one or the other. That is the most important part of that dissent. And it is ironclad. Either it is important that these rights, that any rights that are found in the Constitution explicitly existed in the 18th century or in the 19th century, or they're not good today. Now, of course, this does not apply to the Second Amendment, which was not a personal right until 2008 in this country. Leave your guns outside of Dodge City. I mean, there were permitting process. There were gun restrictions in California in the 60s. I mean, there was no individual right to carry arms that was unencumbered by the state until 2008 in this country. Yet, they just had the audacity to write an opinion that says there was no right to abortion until 1973. I mean, people have to understand that this court is bullshit. And I think, what's his face? Who's that guy who defended Nestle's
Neil Katyal.
Yeah, Katyal, yeah.
Neil Katyal wrote some comment to the thing. Sort of funny that they
very found weird. It.
Very weird. Yeah, very weird. Grow up. I mean, actually, that's the wrong admonition because he knows. He's just trying to make sure that he maintains a relationship with the Supreme Court. But don't say anything publicly then, because it's damaging to the body politic when you diminish this level of hypocrisy. It's damaging. You should shut up. You want to protect your ability to be a solicitor in front of the Supreme Court? God bless. Shut up in public. Don't tweet. Don't go on CNN or MSNBC and spread your BS. If you have nothing truthful and insightful to say, say nothing at all. I mean, really, people need to be held to account. They really do. And then folks need to understand that all of this stuff that we're seeing in terms of individual rights is also happening with far less glitz and gleam and shine in terms of government's ability to protect workers, to protect citizens, to protect our air, to protect our environment, to protect our food, our water, to protect our financial systems, to protect people's homes. I mean, on and on and on. The assault is going to continue. And we don't have a lot of tools to stop it. Electoralism is not nearly sufficient, but it is absolutely necessary. Come at me and tell me again about the value of your vote for some third-party candidate and why it was a joke to vote based upon the Supreme Court. People need to educate themselves. It doesn't matter what policy you're in favor of. It doesn't matter. With a court like this, both houses and the president, although Biden said he wouldn't, could sign Medicare for All tomorrow. And it would be struck down by this time next year, before it even got implemented. And if you think otherwise, that's insane. That's insane. Honestly, it's insane to think otherwise. They couldn't even get Medicaid to be expanded with this court. And that was a position that was a compromise position that John Roberts got thrown under the bus in the pages of the Wall Street Journal before. And why he lost this round when it came to Roe v. Wade. That's the bottom line. All right, we're going to go into the fun half. It's not going to be fun. I mean, and maybe some of it will be fun. I'll do my best. But it is...
Well, there's some fun Ron Johnson stuff that we can distract ourselves with.
It is depressing. I'm not going to lie. Because to the extent that there has been a singular mission on this program when it comes to any particular issues... It was, you know, try and add a level of sophistication to people's understanding of the courts and their importance. And this is just it could very well be the most egregious thing that the court does, just in terms of like, you've rolled back a 50-year precedent, but also it is the first time in this country we have ever rolled back an individual right. And less academically, it's going to cost lives. It's going to immiserate hundreds of thousands of people. It's going to increase child poverty. It's going to inhibit the lives of millions of women, millions and millions of women. It's also sending a message that we have two classes of citizens in this country. The ones that have some autonomy over their body and the ones that don't. But there will be a whole host of things that are going to fundamentally impact your daily lives. I mean, we will see it. More people will, we will have climate change, will come maybe a little quicker, a little harsher, maybe, because we have no mechanisms to mitigate it. You will maybe, I don't know what the numbers are, how many people know somebody who dies of food poisoning, who dies of cancer or have asthma, but those numbers will go up. You'll know more of those people over time. I mean, it just goes on and on. All right. I'm in. I think, like, you know, the best thing that we can hope out of this is that it lights a fire under people and it motivates people to change Democratic leadership and to have them and to figure out how to change leadership, change the nature of the party, but also still prevent Republicans from coming in doing more damage, because they will. And also, you know, people have got to focus on helping those people around them. You know, if you want to donate money, look for a local organization, state organization, that is going to help women get abortion services. There's going to be 26 states in this country where it's going to be banned. And like I say, don't tell me about exceptions. That's irrelevant, because those exceptions will not create abortion opportunities even for those people, because a ban like this, where things are criminalized, and they will be criminalized in every state, I promise you, will inhibit healthcare providers from providing health services to women. Period. End of story. That's just the reality. That is just the reality. So find local organizations. You will hear from them. Support them. Get involved. It's going to take a lot of people helping. And again, I would not be surprised if we see a federal ban by 2026. Okay. We'll take some phone calls on the fun half today. 646-257-3920 is the number. And we will take your IMs. And I'll remind you, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only support the free show, you get the free show free of commercials. Although I think we're going to put the Sebede ad in there and the Just Coffee ads in there today. Those are companies I really like. I like those people a lot. A lot. But it's your support that makes this show possible. If you can't afford it and you want access to the fun half, join them, send us an email, put into the subject line, fun half. Otherwise, go to jointhemajorityreport.com, support the program. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian media universe?
We'll be having Andrew Perez of The Lever on to talk about dark money in the Supreme Court. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning on Sunday. Tonight at 7:30, I'll be doing a Twitch stream, probably playing either Oberdin or NBA 2K and talking about the Supreme Court. So twitch.tv/LeftReckoning. Go follow us.
See you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now. And I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now. And I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now. But I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Unpacked. Matt.
Who?
Unpacked.
What is up, everyone?
Unpacked. Nomi Keen.
You did it.
Unpacked.
Let's go, Brandon.
Unpacked. Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false. No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Is this me?
Yes.
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello? Is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go start
off. Libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say.
857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this.
Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all, my favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.